This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Who is trying to kill solar power in America? As energy activist Nancy LaPlaca reveals, state by state, fossil fuel companies are trying to stop competition from safe, renewable power. Then we look at developing court evidence in Canada that fracking for gas and oil is polluting drinking water. Veteran Canadian investigative journalist Andrew Nikiforuk fills in this key part of the shadows of fracking. We'll wind up with part of my ongoing conversation with permaculture guru Albert Bates. Why is the worst news more popular than the best solutions? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock This Week. In May of 2013, we asked energy activist Nancy LaPlaca why the sun-drenched state of Arizona burns so much coal. Nancy has moved to North Carolina, where she's helping uncover a national plot by big power companies to slow down solar power in America. Nancy, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, the cost of solar has fallen almost in half. It should be sweeping the United States. Is it?
It's kind of a complex story, and I would say yes and no. Solar has been growing at an exponential rate. Been growing quickly across the United States, but unevenly. You'd be surprised that there's not much growth in certain really sunny states like New Mexico or Arizona, and then there's been a lot of growth in places like Massachusetts and New Jersey. The biggest thing that's coming up is that the 30% federal investment tax credit is going to expire at the end of 2016. And so all the solar analysts see a huge drop-off at the end of 2016. So the problem there, Alex, is that we don't have market certainty. And so when you have a business situation without certainty, you've got people who bail and you've got companies that go bankrupt because they don't have enough sales to keep things going.
So according to the Washington Post on March 7, 2015, big U.S. utilities are fighting a campaign against rooftop solar power. What is the story there?
Yeah, that's an interesting story, and that was an excellent article. And in a nutshell, the utilities are a unique group, a unique business in our society. In many states, they have monopolies. In other words, no one else can compete. They also have extremely high costs, and they're called fixed costs. So in other words, the cost to run a coal plant, to run a nuclear power plant, is very high. And so when you start bleeding sales, even a little bit of sales, a small drop in revenue, a small drop in sales, can equal a very large drop in profit because the utility first must cover its very high fixed cost to run the power plant, to pay the people, to buy the fuel, to pay for the emissions control, hopefully. To run the power plant is expensive, and so the utilities fear even a small drop in sales, because when customers go to solar, those sales are lost permanently.
Yeah, I know they have to take into consideration their stock values. They take out bonds, they take out debt and loans to have these fuel plants that are slated to run until 2040 and beyond. But if they do that, Nancy, by that time the world climate will be ruined with no way to stop runaway climate change. I'm wondering, is there a solution to this mess? Nancy, do you think some grid giants could go bankrupt if they can't or won't transition to clean power?
Oh, yes, we could very easily see it. I mean, look at the coal industry, which has lost literally 90% of its value in the last couple of years. The coal industry is going bankrupt, has gone bankrupt. However, we're still burning coal in power plants. So those utilities, even though the owners of the coal mines may change, the utilities are still burning coal. And you bring up a very valid point. If indeed, for example, we don't have as much natural gas as the shale industry would like you to believe, we could end up with literally many, many tens and even hundreds of billions of dollars in what's called stranded assets. So an analogy, Alex, is what happened after Chernobyl when all of a sudden all those nuclear power plants that were being built came to a halt. Those assets were basically stranded. And so ratepayers paid for them quietly. Many folks didn't realize they were paying maybe, you know, 50 cents a month on their power bill for a nuclear power plant that never got built. But the possibility of stranded assets is very real. And if you look at folks like the carbon bubble folks, Carbon Tracker, who are talking about a carbon bubble, this is part of that. Those assets could be literally abandoned either because we realize that due to climate change we can't burn that carbon, because we run out of fuel, because the fuel becomes too expensive.
Well, in a way, I'd love to show my grandson, you see that monster power plant over there, it used to burn coal or oil or gas, and now it doesn't anymore because we've learned, but we'll see if that day comes. Let's get specific. Now, in North Carolina, the big power is Duke Energy. Duke brags they've got a $3 billion wind and solar division. Are they sincere about wanting to get off fossil fuels?
You know, this is an interesting story. Certainly not in North Carolina. Duke Energy buys solar plants all over the country. They own quite a few in Arizona and California and in other states. But here in North Carolina, their home state, their plan for clean energy is 4% by 2029. That's in 15 years. So in other words, Duke Energy only plans to be 4% clean energy by 2029. And that is just simply inadequate. The other irony is that Duke Energy engages in deals that are illegal here. And many of us believe and have good reason to believe that Duke Energy is behind the legislative and other regulatory efforts to stifle clean energy. So in other words, Duke Energy takes advantage of certain financial arrangements that are legal in other states, but they're making them illegal here in North Carolina, and that's why we in North Carolina are looking at kind of a very difficult solar future at the end of this year.
So what is going on with the solar situation in North Carolina?
Well, we're also kind of unique in that virtually all of our solar is wholesale. In other words, it's very large scale. And, in fact, Duke Energy has taken half of the solar tax credits. Now, we still have right now, it's going to change at the end of the year in a few short months, a thriving solar industry where every dollar that was spent in solar tax credits, we had very generous state tax credits of 35%. In other words, if you invested a dollar in solar, you could write off 35% of that. That tax credit is going to end at the end of the year. Duke Energy took half of the $200 million total that was spent on those tax credits over the last 7 years. However, when you look at those tax credits, every dollar that came out of taxpayers' pockets returned $1.54 to the tax coffers. In other words, it was a net gain, so that every dollar citizens spent on tax breaks came back in property and other taxes $1.54. In addition, every dollar spent on taxes came back as 10 to 20 times that amount of economic activity. In other words, the citizens spend a dollar on a tax credit, but it ends up building $20 worth of solar. And that $20 worth of solar returns $1.54 to the tax coffers. So it was really very foolish for the state legislature to kill the extension of the state tax credit and also to kill this certain finance arrangement known as third-party solar, which would allow no-money-down solar. And one last thing about this third-party solar that's very interesting, Alex, is Duke Energy is right now in six states, and in five of the states that don't allow third-party sales, four of them are Duke Energy states. Florida is one, North Carolina, Kentucky, and Indiana. So I think we could say that Duke Energy is working actively to stop this very successful financing mechanism that is responsible for at least 80% of the solar that's been built in the country.
And I know that kind of financing and other plans are available in Europe, and it's flourishing there because of it. Well, look, it seems like the American states with the most sun, as you say, have some of the worst records for solar power. Take Florida. How are they doing?
Yeah, that's a great question, Alex. Florida is a very interesting state. They're 61% gas, natural gas. They're 23% coal, and they're 12% nuclear, and they have a negligible amount of solar. The reason they don't have much solar is because this financing arrangement called third-party solar, where basically you can build solar for no money down, that is illegal in Florida. There's a huge battle going on right now in Florida with a ballot initiative that would allow this, and then the utilities, a utility-backed group, went and filed their own initiative. So it's sort of a battle of the initiative, because if you can create doubt and confusion, you can at least prevent the other side from winning. But Florida really is a sad case, because the Sunshine State has very little solar.
That is ironic. And after we talked a couple of years ago, how is solar power doing in Arizona?
Arizona is another interesting case, Alex. Arizona is now at about 5% solar and about 40% coal. And they continue to operate some of the dirtiest, oldest coal plants in the United States, which is really sad, because they could easily be replaced with solar. I hear from my solar developer friends in Arizona that you could install utility-scale solar for 6 cents a kilowatt hour. And really, that's way cheaper than you could do it on the East Coast here in North Carolina. And the reason that they don't really, Alex, is because they can generate coal-fired electricity from a dirty power plant for 3 cents. They don't pay that 17 to 27 cents in health and environmental damages. Those just get dumped on us. They don't really pay the cost of coal ash, mercury, acid rain, you know, asthma, lost work days, et cetera. All they do is generate that coal kilowatt hour for 3 cents, and they do have other expenses, sell it for 11 or 12 cents, and make a profit. They don't want to go solar because, frankly, that means someone else gets the business. And in Salt River Project territory, they added a $50 a month fee to anyone who puts solar up on their roof. And so basically solar installations in that utility's area, and they have about a million customers, went down 90%. So in the world of solar, I'd say Arizona is, frankly, I'm sorry to say, something of a laughingstock. It's the sunniest place in the country, in the world, that is literally killing solar.
That's amazing. So if I put solar panels up on my roof and I want to hook into the grid and sell it to the utility, they're going to charge me an extra $50 a month?
Yes. Yes, in Salt River Project territory, yes, that's exactly what they're going to do.
That's outrageous. So what is going on with solar regulations in the U.S. Northeast?
The Northeast is interesting because that's what's called a deregulated market, Alex. And so in a regulated market, a utility like Duke Energy would go to the Utilities Commission and say, hey, we want to build a power plant. We want to build a gas plant. We want to build a nuclear plant. So give us the okay, and then we'll come back later and we'll give the ratepayers the bill. Well, in these deregulated markets, it's very different. You bid power in to an open market where the cost of power fluctuates daily. The reason that solar is flourishing in the Northeast is because you have some very forward-thinking utilities commissions that have given extra value to solar, or they've allowed certain types of solar. For example, one of the real no-brainers that hasn't gone anywhere yet but will is this idea of community solar. So community solar means I have too many trees in my house, I can't put up solar, but maybe me and 20 other people could go pay for a solar array, you know, 2 miles away in a nice, big, sunny, open field, and we would own it, and that's called community solar. States like Minnesota, Massachusetts, they're allowing community solar, and so that is flourishing. New York has some excellent solar policies. So does New Jersey, Massachusetts, Vermont. And so for that reason, solar is actually doing far better up there than it is in many of the sunny southwestern states right now. It's odd. The other interesting thing that's happening up in the Northeast is what's called demand response, which is sort of energy efficiency on steroids, where you could ask large energy users like Costco or Walmart to cut their energy use and pay them. That has been flourishing in that market, which is allowing utilities to burn less coal and gas, but they're trying to kill it because energy efficiency is undercutting nuclear and gas. And so again, if these utilities can't sell enough power, they start to go in the red. So they don't want more energy efficiency.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest energy activist Nancy LaPlaca. We're talking about kind of a plot by big power corporations against solar power. So Nancy, what are the institutions and deep lobby groups fighting solar power in America?
Well, of course, there's the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, it's called. There are the Koch brothers. There is the Edison Electric Institute, which is a nonprofit trade group that represents the investor-owned utilities. There are various trade groups that represent the natural gas industry, the coal industry. Basically, it's the fossil fuel companies and the electric utilities. And they are working to stop clean energy. And the Koch brothers, of course, are part of that. There's a lot of good work being done out there by Common Cause, by the Energy and Policy Institute, by Media Matters for America, by lots of good nonprofits that are looking at the connections and seeing where these, what we call astroturf groups, are getting their money to fight solar.
Nancy, talk to us about the role of the public utilities commissions that you mentioned in the struggle for solar, and can citizens directly affect those commissions, or are they captured by these grid power corporations?
You know, that's a lot of the crux of the matter. Most states, the governor appoints the utilities commissioners. In most states, the utilities are very, very big campaign cash contributors. So if you look at North Carolina, our governor, Pat McCrory, worked for Duke Energy for over 25 years. The Senate Majority Leader, Mike Hager, who helped kill solar, he worked for Duke Energy for many years. So you see this unholy alliance. In Arizona, Arizona Public Service Company, it will not deny it, and there's good evidence that they spent $3.2 million electing friendly commissioners. So some states, most states, commissioners are appointed by the governor, who unfortunately generally is tied up with campaign cash to the utilities. And then in the few states where they're elected, there's 13 states where they're elected, the utilities jump in and spend a lot of money. And so unfortunately, you've got a situation where these agencies are kind of secret. People don't even know about them. If you look at North Carolina and you consider that this group of seven commissioners, they are making decisions worth billions and billions and billions of dollars, tens of billions, even hundreds of billions over years. And yet you can't even get on the phone and listen to a hearing. You have to go there in person. You can't get on your computer and listen to what's going on. You have to go there in person. And so all we can do, groups like us, is shine a light, because as we know, sunshine is the best disinfectant. And so with an era of Citizens United, it's difficult, but you know, there are many of us out there working to show that solar isn't dying because it doesn't work. It's struggling because the utilities and their allies are spending lots of money to hold it down.
Nancy, we know that in Europe, Asia, and even Middle East oil-producing countries, they're investing heavily in solar power. I'm worried about what happens to America when climate change becomes so obvious that carbon taxes or outright bans on dirty fuels like coal finally arrive in the United States. What happens to a country that doubles down on the energy sources of the past?
That's a question I've thought about a lot, Alex. And my hope is that money that we've, you know, thrown down the drain, if we end up with stranded assets, all these pipelines, natural gas pipelines, all these power plants that we're not going to be able to use, coal plants, what will happen, I hope, is there's enough money left in the world and enough smart people to figure out the financing mechanisms that we can invest directly in our own clean energy. I believe, and the groups I work with, NC Warren and Climate Voices, in the democratization of electricity. And so my hope is that there are smart people out there who will make it happen and who will, for example, a green energy bank. I understand we're the only modern country that doesn't have a green energy bank, where you have a way for clean energy developers to borrow money at low interest. For example, there's a thing called the Master Limited Partnership. The shale oil industry has benefited greatly, tar sands, shale gas, oil industry, gas industry, and yet solar and wind are cut out. And so we're missing these huge pools of money that are available to the dirty energy providers, that are not available to the clean energy providers. And that is my hope, Alex, that there's enough of us who work on this that we keep these ideas going and that we all recognize that it's about the financing. And so once we pivot, we hopefully can put these processes and rules and financial arrangements in place that allow clean energy to grow quickly.
Tell us just briefly about the organizations you work with, North Carolina Warren and Climate Voices, and maybe give us a couple of places where we could go to find out more about this solar power story.
Well, thanks, Alex. Yeah, it's NC Warren, and that stands for North Carolina Warren, www.ncwarn.org, and also climatevoicesus.org, not Climate Voices, but climatevoicesus.org. And basically, we are motivated by we want a cleaner, greener world. We want clean electricity. We're very concerned about climate change. We're opposing Duke Energy's huge natural gas push. We are working with coal ash impacted communities because you probably heard that North Carolina had a huge coal ash spill. We have 150 million tons of coal ash in this state. We have 32 coal ash ponds with no lining, no groundwater monitoring. We're working on helping those communities. And we're helping to provide what's called solarized programs, where you bulk buy solar for communities that want to put up solar.
We've been talking with energy activist Nancy LaPlaca. You can find links to everything we've talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Thank you, Alex. My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock, covering what the mainstream media leaves out. We are often ahead of breaking news. On September 30th, I interviewed Neela Banerjee from Inside Climate News about their investigation into ExxonMobil. That company was warned by their own scientists, starting in the 1970s, that their products would generate dangerous climate change. In the 1990s, Exxon funded groups specializing in sowing doubt or outright denial of climate change. Now, 2 months later, the Attorney General of the state of New York is investigating ExxonMobil. The state wants to know if the world's largest oil and gas company misled the public and shareholders. You heard it here first. President Obama killed off the Keystone Pipeline project, which hoped to bring dirty tar sands oil south to American refineries on the Gulf of Mexico. Obama actually spoke these words, which have been a theme on Radio EcoShock for almost a decade.
Because ultimately, if we're going to prevent large parts of this earth from becoming not only inhospitable, but uninhabitable in our lifetimes, we're going to have to keep some fossil fuels in the ground rather than burn them and release more dangerous pollution into the sky.
It's another nail in the collapsing tar sands project, but fracking in Western Canada continues at a mad rate, causing earthquakes and widespread pollution of water resources. Let's reach out to the best reporter on the case. Calgary, Alberta is the headquarters of Canada's boom and bust oil and gas industry, including the infamous tar sands and fracking. It takes guts to live there doing exposés on the damage done. That's what investigative journalist and author Andrew Nikiforuk did for the past 25 years, and he's still at it. His latest book is Slick Water, Fracking, and One Insider's Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry. Andrew Nikiforuk, I've been reading and admiring your work for years. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex.
Now, on this program, I've covered fracking in Pennsylvania, New York State, Montana, California, but I don't know much about fracking in my own country, in Canada. But just before we go there, I'd like to briefly talk about the oil patch, the Canadian tar sands. Can we get a quick update from you on what's happening there?
Well, with the fall in oil prices, there's a rather dramatic shakeup going on in places like Fort McMurray and also in the offices of some of the major oil and gas companies in Calgary. Everyone thought that the boom would never end, and everyone thought the price of oil would just get higher. And, of course, none of that has turned out to be true. And the markets for really heavy junk crude like bitumen seem to be declining, not growing. The economic fallout in China, you know, is another warning signal to this industry that the demand that everyone thought would be there for bitumen is simply shrinking. And then when you add all of the concerns about carbon liabilities and carbon emissions, that the tar sands might not have the long life that certainly the Alberta government and the industry hoped it would.
Yeah, there's been 54,000 layoffs, I read just the other day, in Alberta and more in Saskatchewan. Shell just abandoned a $2 billion project that they had going. It's really hard to predict where this is going to go.
And there are lots of companies in the United States, too, that are fracking in the Bakken and elsewhere, and they've all declared bankruptcy or posting incredible write-downs. This is a major dramatic shift, and what it will mean in the end is, well, more volatile oil prices for sure, I would think, but also that, you know, the industry is being given a very strong message that it is a dying industry, not a growing one.
And then we have Canada's top tar sands salesman and the anti-climate activist, Prime Minister Stephen Harper. What does his loss in October in the election just held, what does that mean for Canada's role now?
Well, hopefully it means a different role. I mean, Harper was, again, a great promoter of pipelines and a great promoter of exporting bitumen, which if you take all the climate scientists in the country and put them together, they'd say, look, this is not something, this product is too dirty for us to export, and we really need a program to get off bitumen. And it might be a 30 or 40 year program to do that. And hopefully with Trudeau, we might begin to see a recognition of the real economic and environmental liabilities associated with tar sands and any expansion of the tar sands. So you can't really address climate change and approve pipelines at the same time. It's craziness.
You know, along those lines, in 2012, you wrote a really unusual book titled The Energy of Slaves, Oil, and the New Servitude. Could you just give us a snapshot of what your argument was there?
Well, it was a philosophical book really looking at why we use energy the way we do and how high energy consumption has really changed modern life. It's very much responsible for our obsession with quantity of stuff, our obsession with speed, our obsession with the concentration of companies and the concentration of governments has changed the very nature of what it means to be human. And so the book basically asks the question, well, you know, how do we change that? Now, the cheap energy has been used to create this incredibly complex civilization. And now that cheap hydrocarbons are on their way out, and we're only left with extreme and difficult stuff, and green and renewable energy, which also comes with its own unique set of challenges and problems and lower energy returns, then where do we go? So it was a really philosophical look at those questions.
Okay, let's get to your new book. Is there a lot of fracking in Canada, and where is it mainly located?
Oh, Alex, there's a monstrous amount of fracking taking place in Canada, and it's an issue that most Canadians are not aware of. So there's an enormous amount of fracking taking place in northern British Columbia. In fact, some of the world's largest fracks have taken there, and the fracking of shale basins there has caused hundreds and hundreds of earthquakes. Same thing in Alberta. We have an enormous amount of fracking has taken place in the province. It used to be largely vertical fracks, but in the last 10 years, we've seen a lot of fracking of horizontal well bores, particularly along the eastern slopes of the Rockies, where companies have been chasing after tight oil deposits similar to the Bakken in North Dakota. And there again, the fracking has created a number of problems, everything from gas migration to groundwater contamination to really significant earthquakes, the highest being 4.8 up in Fox Creek, Alberta, which pose a real threat to public safety because nothing has been built to withstand that level of man-made seismic activity.
Now, the heroine in your book is Jessica Ernst. Do you want to just give us a little introduction? Who is she?
Well, she's a remarkable woman and very different kind of character when you think about the enormous controversies that have been associated with fracking. So she's different in the sense that she's part of the industry. I mean, for more than 25 years, she worked for some of the country's largest oil and gas companies, including Encana, Murphy Oil, Chevron, the Great Canadian Oil Sands Company. So she brings to the story the perspective of somebody that knows the industry intimately, who thought it was actually being fairly regulated, and that if something went wrong, it would be addressed in due time. And she discovered that none of that was true. The other interesting thing about Jessica Ernst is that she's incredibly stubborn, obstinate, and incredibly determined. And she's now been in a lawsuit with the government of Alberta, Encana, and the energy regulator for 10 years. And what makes this, again, unique is that in most of these cases, people get tired, they get worn out, they get burned out, and they settle. And when they settle, any record of contamination is taken off the public record. You know, the companies will give you a check, you sign a confidentiality agreement, and then it all goes away. And regulators love this because then there's really no record of groundwater contamination or any problem. And why Jessica's case is so important and why I think industry and government are so concerned about it is, one, she's got the evidence, and two, she will not settle out of court. She wants it all on the public record.
So what brought her to the breaking point of saying, I'm going to have to sue the government and the company that I had worked for, Encana?
Well, what happened briefly was during an incredible fracking boom in central Alberta in the Horseshoe Canyon, Encana fracked a number of shallow coalbed methane wells. And one of those wells, it fracked directly into fresh water and affected a number of aquifers around the community of Rosebud. And when this was brought to Jessica's attention and when she started to investigate it and ask questions, you know, she ran into a brick wall with the regulator. Alberta Environment then conducted a really bogus investigation. I mean, to this day, Alberta Environment does not have a protocol for investigating methane contamination of groundwater related to oil and gas activities, which is astounding when you think that nearly 500,000 wells have been drilled in Alberta. And when she realized that the regulators weren't going to do the right thing, and when she realized that Encana was just ignoring it, she said, okay, I really have no choice here. I'm going to have to sue. And she did so reluctantly. I mean, nobody really wants to do this kind of thing. But she said, wow, you know, groundwater is a public resource. And once it's contaminated, it travels. And you just can't walk away from that kind of abuse of a public resource. So she's been in the courts now for 10 years. Her case is going, actually, to the Supreme Court in January and February of this year in Canada, which is, again, a remarkable achievement.
You mentioned coal bed methane, and I've heard that in Australia and even in the UK, but I don't really understand. Are there two different kinds of fracking?
Well, no, fracking comes in all kinds of different ways. I mean, you can use gases to frack and crack rocks, such as nitrogen, and that's commonly used to crack open coal seams. You can use water, you can use petroleum distillate, gasoline, diesel fuel. You can use all kinds of different chemicals, and then you can also, and quite often you use a lot of sand or proppants to keep these cracks open so that the gas or oil can move from the fractured rock formation. The fracking of coal seams has got a fairly long history and a very problematic and controversial one. So they started fracking coal seams in the San Juan Basin in Colorado back in the 1980s. They did the same in Alabama, in Wyoming, and everywhere they did, they ran into problems. Coal is much more shallow than most oil and gas formations. It's also one of the world's most highly fractured rocks. And cracking it even more ultimately is just going to release a lot of that methane that's trapped in the coal. And I was just in Wyoming last week, where I met dozens and dozens of ranchers who lost their water as a result of the fracking of shallow coal seams in that state.
So, speaking of history, one incredible story in your book concerns using nuclear weapons for fracking. Did that really happen?
It did. I mean, the history of fracking is almost like something that Monty Python might have written about. But it's all about the escalation of brute force. You know, in the 1950s, they were fracking largely with diesel fuel, napalm, water, and river sand. And it was Halliburton and Schlumberger that pioneered that sort of fracking. And they were often very shallow fracks, and they were vertical in the wellbore. There was no horizontal fracking at that time. And then in the 1960s, you know, scientists sort of thought, well, you know, this is very labor-intensive, all of this vertical fracking. Maybe there's a shortcut. Maybe we could just set off a bomb in some of these very tight oil and gas deposits that are not economic to drill at the moment and see what happens. So they did. So Project Gas Buggy in Colorado took a nuclear bomb and they blew it up underground, about 3,000, 4,000 meters underground, only to discover that there really is no market for radioactive gas. So the Russians did the same thing and also found that there is no market for radioactive oil or gas.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest journalist and author, Andrew Nikiforuk. We're talking about his new book on fracking, Slick Water. What was the Alberta government's response to complaints that fracking had ruined aquifers and people's drinking water? Did they come out to protect the public?
No, they didn't. What they did, number one, was they said, well, this is unfortunate, we'll look into it. But then their investigations were completely fraudulent, as I documented in the book. And then they said, well, it's all natural and it was always that way. There's always methane in groundwater. We shouldn't be too concerned about it. When in fact, you know, when Jessica Ernst was presented with that story, she said, you know, that's bullshit. And so she hired a hydrologist to actually go back and do a forensic look at groundwater around her community. And so she looked at, I think, at the record of 2,500 different water wells. And she found that only about four or five actually had any record. And when your water well is drilled and brought on, it is almost always tested for gas. And the public record will say gas present, yes or no. You know, there was less than half a dozen wells in her area that where there was gas present. And other scientists had said, too, the interesting thing about the coal basin that Encana and other companies fracked into later was that it was a very tight coal, and that, you know, the methane really clung to the coal seams, and it took a lot of experimental fracking to get it to migrate to the surface. And again, so, I mean, people did not have problems with methane coming into their water wells until this massive experiment had taken place by fracking in the coal.
Another problem I didn't fully understand until I read your book is the noise pollution from fracking operations. What happened to Jessica Ernst's peaceful homestead near Rosebud, Alberta?
Well, there are lots of different noise sources, but the one that has really driven a lot of rural people crazy are the compressors. So these coal formations are underpressurized, and once you frack them and the gas is released, you need to draw that gas up, and that's what the compressor stations do. They kind of act like these very noisy vacuum cleaners on the landscape. And the noise got so terrible for Jessica Ernst, I mean, and these compressor stations were nearly a mile away, that she could not sleep at night. There have been cases in Wyoming where residents have been driven crazy by the noise, and they've actually gone out and, you know, with a 30-30 put holes in them. And then, of course, been arrested by the state police. But what happens when this kind of oil and gas activity comes into a community, it basically industrializes the community. You get noise from heavy traffic because so many trucks are needed to service these low-producing wells. You get noise from the compressors. You'll get noise from the actual fracking activity and drilling activity. And the whole quality of life of a rural place dramatically changes. I mean, urban people would never tolerate the scale of industrialization that comes with fracking.
Right, and people went there to be peaceful in the first place. How does your story tie into terrorism? I mean, the police show up, and not just any police, on Jessica's doorstep. What happened there?
Well, it's, again, an interesting story. I mean, when Jessica went public with what happened to her water, the regulator responded by branding her a security threat and a criminal threat to the organization. And, I mean, this was a fraudulent claim. And they did so so that they wouldn't have to talk to her, and hoping that they would terrify her and shut her up for good. And they really didn't understand Jessica Ernst. And they later admitted, 6 months after they had banished all communication with her, that, look, Jessica, you never were a threat to us. We know you are not dangerous, but you publicly humiliated us by pointing out how negligent we were, and that's why we banished you. And so a couple of years after they did this, the RCMP came to her door as well. In fact, just a week after she was on national television in Canada, and it was members of the anti-terrorist squad. And so when they came up to Jess's place, she grabbed her camera and started taking photographs of them to have a record of it. She also fortunately had some neighbors at her house at the time, so she had witnesses. And the police were quite startled, and they had arrived unannounced, of course, and said, look, you can't take pictures of us. We're plainclothes policemen. And Jessica invited them to sit outside on her porch in metal chairs, and it was about minus 15 degrees outside at the time. And then they proceeded to interview her. And what they really wanted to know was and what she found was to be absolutely appalling. They wanted to know the names and the phone numbers and addresses of all the ranchers and farmers that had called her for help over the years on issues related to fracking. And there were hundreds of them. And she said, no way, you're not getting any of that information. And why are you here? And why are you trying to harass me? Are you trying to silence me? And in the end, the policemen, who were very polite, also were very sheepish. And they apologized three or four times. And whoever sent them there, whether it was in Canada or the government, I don't know. But it was an example of how the state can terrify ordinary people when they are merely doing the right thing and trying to hold the state and their government accountable for the greater good.
Now, look, with this lawsuit against Encana and the government, is Jessica Ernst in it for the money, and how does she pay for what must be big legal bills?
Well, she's not in it for the money, but in order to get the attention of the government in Canada and the regulator, you have to pick a big figure for a lawsuit. So she has sued all of them for negligence and breaking the law, as well as violating her constitutional rights, for $33 million. And that sounds like a big sum, but in Canada, no lawsuit ever settles for that amount of money. And she's not in it for the money. To her, the big issue is to put this abuse of groundwater and rural people and all on the public record. And that's simply her goal. And at this point in time, she has spent $350,000 of her own money on this case. In the last year, I think ordinary citizens across Canada and the United States have contributed somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 to her case. And 15% of the proceeds of Slick Water will go to support her legal challenge here.
So your book seems to make the case that winning a final judgment isn't really the biggest goal. I mean, what are the reverberations around the world of Jessica Ernst standing up for this?
Well, they are many. The first is that she has the scientific evidence that demonstrates that everything industry has said about fracking is false, that fracking does contaminate groundwater, that fracking does release gases that travel into other well bores and other formations and into other pathways that comes to the surface. And she's proven as well that one of the really big issues with fracking is that it rattles the existing oil and gas plumbing on the landscape and aggravates the existing problems with leaking gases. And so she's got all of the goods there, and she's got a really, really tight case where she's caught a company fracking directly into groundwater and where she's caught a government that did not uphold the law and enforce the law. So if she is successful in the end, and if all of this is proven beyond any doubt in a court of law, then it could change the way fracking is regulated in Canada. Her case has already changed the attitudes of thousands of citizens about fracking. So in Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, I mean, Jessica Ernst is hailed as a folk hero, and her case is hailed as an example of how no one can properly regulate this highly dysfunctional and uncontrollable technology.
You know, I have to admit, I came away from reading your book with a slight feeling of hopelessness. Yes, we have brave individuals, we have citizen groups toiling for truth, but what a great machine of corruption and protection for pollution, you know, coming from the very institutions that are supposed to be protecting the public, so they say. In your heart of hearts, Andrew, do you think fracking in the tar sands will go on until the land, water, and climate are ruined? Or is there some hope that we could turn this around and make it sane?
Well, I don't think we can really make this technology sane. It is brute force technology. And there is a form of fracking taking place in the tar sands, and it's called the steam injection. And there are just as many problems with that as there are with fluid injection in oil and gas and coal deposits. But I always think about St. Augustine, who said that hope had two very brilliant daughters, and one was anger at the way things are, and the other was courage, the courage to change the things that must be changed. And Jessica Ernst is one of those sisters. And whether she actually finds justice at the end of the day in her case, and I actually believe she will, but it will take a long time and will take enormous amount of energy and emotion to get there, that her case is really going to make a difference.
All right. So, Andrew, you have a long history of books and articles that matter. What are you working on next?
Well, at the moment, I'm just working on how LNG and fracking in British Columbia poses risks and challenges to this good province.
Ah, yes, the LNG story. That's worth a book or three. Okay, so from Calgary, Alberta, we've been talking with Andrew Nikiforuk, a writer and author on environmental rights and wrongs, living in the Dragon's Den. Find out more at andrewnikiforuk.com. His last name is spelled Nikiforuk. And you can look for Andrew's new book, Slick Water, Fracking and One Insider's Stand Against the World's Most Powerful Industry. Thank you for your work all these years, Andrew.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. As always, you can download or forward these interviews as separate MP3 files using links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. I'll also load you up with links to follow on each story. I've had an ongoing discussion about solutions with Albert Bates. Regular listeners heard his talk and interviews at the recent Permaculture Convergence in London. Here's an excerpt from another talk I had with Albert, where I asked him about the mystery of our longing for news of the collapse and the real meaning of a permanent culture. Albert, maybe you can help me with a problem. If I do a Radio EcoShock show covering how bad things are, we get twice the downloads of a program with positive solutions like permaculture. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that people feel they sense the shadows that their future throws, which is a phrase that Ivan Illich coined. And I think it's appropriate because the future does look a bit dark and people are worried. People are sensing that there's something out there. They can't quite put words to it entirely. It's kind of an inchoate fear. It's just kind of lurking at the edges of their subconscious. And so they respond when you say something that's like, okay, this is the dire future. This is what's going to happen. And then this is going to happen. And then this could even happen. And oh my gosh, this could happen. Well, people sort of in a very deep level resonate with that. And that's why the downloads immediately pick up. They want to know. People want to know. And the sad thing is we can't really say with any certainty that the more independent variables you have, the less you can say about the effect of any one of them. And so right now we're in this large, complex quantum entanglement of different vectors of finance and climate and the politics of the world and the peak everything. All of these lines that are coming across each other, as was predicted by the Club of Rome back in the 1970s, it's all coming to play right now. And so there's so little that anybody can predict that any prediction at all is grasped upon.
I think people have a hard time grasping what permaculture is, and you teach this subject in workshops around the world. So what the heck is permaculture?
That one's easy. You know, it was started by a couple of university folk back in Australia in the early or mid-1970s. Bill Mollison was teaching ecology in Tasmania, and his graduate student was David Holmgren. And David Holmgren brought him an idea for a thesis, and Bill sort of refined and honed it and got David working in the right direction. And what they were working on was the idea that agriculture as we know it, it has become very synthetic. It's become very dependent on fossil fuels and on different kinds of inputs that actually make it very vulnerable and brittle. We're reducing the number of crops to a very small number, the number of genotypes to even smaller. And so we tend to put ourselves in a situation where we're asking for trouble. And David looked more at the broad diversity of available crops and energy products and different kinds of things and said, you know, we could do this in a much more resilient, regenerative way. And they came to call that, the two of them, permaculture in the sense of permanent agriculture. But after a short amount of publishing on the subject, they came to realize it's not just agriculture. It's not just food. It's actually permanent culture. It's everything we do, the houses, the built environment in lots of ways, the infrastructure, the roads, the cities, the methods of transportation. All of these things actually can be done in a much more resilient, regenerative way, and it's a design process. And that's really the revelation, is that it is something that we are capable of designing better if we actually undertake to learn a design methodology. So permaculture is teaching a design methodology for what I would call a cultivated ecology. We want to follow nature. We want to do things the way that nature wants to go already. Nature is a magnificent healer. It's something with a billion-year store of knowledge. And so what we really want to do is just fall into step with nature and just tweak it to meet our needs a little bit here and there, go along with what its major programs are, but then get a little bit off for ourselves so we can have food and housing and so forth. That's permaculture.
Well, lately I'm hearing of permaculture economics, and probably permaculture psychology is next. Can the definition of permaculture grow so large that its core gets lost?
I don't think so. I think that actually permaculture economics is already here, and permaculture psychology as well. It's what we call social permaculture, and it's looking at relationships, how we form a glue that holds our community together, how we transform conflict into something that's more productive, how we can live together at peace and harmony and watch our children grow healthy and so forth. All of that's social permaculture. And I think that any design that doesn't account for the human factor, for the psychology of humans and their hurts and their needs and so forth, is actually a deficiency of the design. So you need to have that component of the social element, and permaculture is coming to that.
At the Convergence, Rosemary Morrow brought up the challenge that billions of humans now live in cities, not eco-villages or even agricultural areas. Can permaculture still work with that situation?
Well, I personally find that my largest challenge if ever I'm asked to do design work in an urban context. I'm not a city person. I have lived in cities. I went to school in New York City, and I've lived in a number of other cities, but I'm really a country boy. I am happiest when I'm out in the middle of nowhere. So for me, to venture into the city is always a bit of a challenge. And then to actually design a more resilient landscape that's in touch with nature, that's following the ways of nature within the urban canyons, I find it very difficult. But nonetheless, some of the principles, in fact, all of the principles, do apply. And if you can apply them there, you can have a much better life. And so we can capture rainwater. We can capture sunlight. We can grow things in cities. We can provide our own food. We can provide many of our needs. And certainly the social environment is very rich. The cultural environment of cities is very rich. I would part company with those who say that the ecological footprint of a city per resident is smaller than the ecological footprint of someone living in a rural area. I just don't buy that. I've seen the math, I've seen the analysis, and I understand where they're coming from, but I have to say it doesn't quite work like that, because cities draw from the periphery to a great extent. There's a food shed that feeds the city. There is a watershed that feeds the city. There are all these different things that have to come together for a city to function, and most of those are neglected externalities in the economics that tells you that cities somehow have a small footprint. They don't. They have an enormous footprint. Can we support cities? Well, if you go back 10,000 years to after the last ice age when we didn't have much in the way of cities, and then gradually cities began to arise, particularly on trade routes, you know, along the Silk Road and so forth, you began to see Minoan cities and Greek cities and Egyptian cities and so forth. You began to concentrate wealth. You began to draw wealth, which is to say aggregates of natural resources, from the periphery to the center in these cities, and it allowed for very productive relationships. You can have worker classes of people, craftspeople, who could begin to learn how to do things to a very high degree of skill. All of those were wonderful innovations, and they created the civilization that we know. But on the other hand, they were a break with the natural order of things. In our DNA, we are essentially critters that grew in tribes of 10, 12, 20 people at the most, and wandering bands, and living in sync with the natural seasons and so forth. And so when we broke and created a city culture, we made a major shift, and that has to be taken into account. And a lot of what we get in terms of social malaise and crime and disagreements amongst people living as close neighbors comes from the fact that we are running contrary to our own DNA programming. And so we have to actually allow for that in any design. In designing the built environment, you have to design privacy gradients. You have to design solar streets and wilderness alleys, places where you can have fingers into the forest, where you can actually touch nature, where you can feel the soil, where your children can actually run wild a little bit. All of those are parts of our nature that we need to account for, and cities have to accommodate that in the design of them in the future.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Stay tuned in the coming weeks for more of my discussion with Albert Bates, former environmental lawyer turned permaculture teacher at the intentional community The Farm in Tennessee. Find links to Albert in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Next week, I'm scheming to bring you a devastating report on the lies we tell ourselves about climate change, and that's just as world leaders prepare for the Paris climate talks. It's harsh news that needs to be told. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for being brave enough to listen and for caring about our world.
Hello, skeptics, not our friends. We've come to share with you again data proving that the Earth's warming is a phenomenon. Because the carbon that we burn with such little care has warmed the air. Among the sound of skeptics, it's not as if this is unknown. The truth's consistently has shown that global sea levels are are left compromising, and the public misinformed by your false logic and cherry picks still hear the sound of skeptics. And in the AR-5 we saw projections that left us in without warning, less and less Arctic ice forming, and the cure, we have to cut our emissions bare, but still you dare create the sound of skeptics. What else will we need to show? Structure that's sustainable, an RCP that is attainable, to spread for the average Joe just steals the show and promotes the sound of skeptics.